This is the Living Prophets Podcast, and I'm your host, Mark Maxmeister. In the previous episode, I talked about identity, and I walked through a journey of understanding my father's identity, concluding where we have to choose whether we're going to be engaged in conversations with others that are about transforming identity instead of trying to replace the people that we disagree with. And this week, I'm looking back at many of the stories in past episodes, which in retrospect are examples of transformation, and giving you nuggets from all of those.
Yesterday afternoon, we had a memorial service for a 90-year-old member of this congregation. That's Lois right there, her picture in front of the flowers. Modest person, hardly a sign-carrying activist. But you know what? In 2013, at age 86, Lois Borison, with her walker, went downtown Raleigh as part of the Moral Monday protest and went right up in there to that restricted space and got herself arrested. And because she had a walker, when they handcuffed her hands behind her back, she couldn't go anywhere. So the police officers had to pick Lois up and carry her over to the police van to take her away and arrest her. And the whole time they're carrying Lois away, these police officers are apologizing to her. How bad do you think those people felt enforcing that law? Do you think maybe those police officers wondered to themselves on their way home, what's wrong with our country if I have to carry an 86-year-old woman off to be arrested? That is effective social justice. That's effective activism, because Lois was changing hearts and minds of the people who were engaged in the oppression. That's how it works. I don't think that the police officers who arrest people for pulling down statues are driving home going, golly, what inspired that 28-year-old to tear down that statue? Are we being effective? Your heart can be in the right place. Your actions can be ineffective. We're about being effective because the stakes are getting higher in this country every single day. I'm afraid to watch the news to find out what's going to happen next. The bedrock belief that Dr. King held was it's all about love. And the people who are oppressing, the people who are persecuting, they are suffering. They're suffering from a love deficit in their lives. And what we need to do is to fill them up with love, because brothers and sisters, when you're full of love, you can't oppress somebody, you can't hurt somebody, you can't harm somebody. When you're filled with love, it takes over your life. And you can't do anything but be loving and overflow with love. So Dr. King believed that the issue was a love deficit. He was embodying that greater love, that higher love, the love that will not let us go. And it was with compassion that he engaged the brokenness of the people who were oppressing in this country. And I don't know about you, but sometimes I look at the news, it's hard for me to touch that place of compassion inside myself and say, oh my God, what a broken human being. What a warped, twisted, distorted person. How much hurt was inflicted on that individual to turn them into who I'm seeing today? It's hard for me to access that place of compassion in myself, but that is the only fuel that is really going to carry us forward to the ultimate vision we hold.
By the time Uli Derrickson died this week of cancer at the age of 60, she'd acquired the middle name Chaya, life in Hebrew, an unexpected middle name for a woman who'd grown up in West Germany. She said it was the most precious of honors that she earned after 2 days of terror and brutality in June of 1985. Ms. Derrickson was the lead flight attendant on TWA Flight 847 that carried 152 passengers and crew on a flight from Athens to Rome. Just after takeoff, two armed hijackers took over the plane. They kicked Uli Derrickson, unpinned a hand grenade, and pistol-whipped the pilots. The Lebanese hijackers spoke German. They made Uli Derrickson their interpreter. She used her position to cajole, mollify, and trick them. The gunman ordered the plane to fly between Beirut and Algiers. Uli Derrickson convinced them to let off 17 elderly women and two children, saying it would look bad for them to get hurt. And the hijacker told her to collect all of the passengers' passports and identify all the Jews. She blandly told them that she didn't know how to recognize a Jew. When she saw what looked like a Jewish name, Uli Derrickson surreptitiously slid the passport to the bottom of the pile. When the ground crew in Algiers demanded to be paid for 6,000 gallons of jet fuel, the hijackers said they would start shooting passengers. Uli Derrickson took out her Shell credit card and bought $5,000 worth of fuel. The hijackers shot Robbie Stedham, the U.S. Navy diver on vacation, and flung out his body. They began to beat his friend Clinton Suggs. Uli Derrickson stepped in front of the sailor and scolded the hijackers like a stern mother. "Enough," she said, "enough." "She saved my life," said Clinton Suggs. "She risked her own." When the hijackers began to beat other passengers, she would chide them like children. "Don't you hit them." Amazingly, they stopped. As the hijacking stretched over 2 days, the gunman swallowed pills to stay awake, growing more jittery and dangerous. Uli Derrickson tried to soothe them by singing soft German songs. The surviving passengers, who were all eventually released, called Uli Derrickson a hero. And not just for one brave, selfless moment, but through 55 hours of terror. She said, "I just didn't want to be helpless. I just didn't want to be helpless."
In 2005, some of you know, I became the only non-military clergy person to meet and speak with prisoners in Guantanamo Bay. I went down there with a couple of attorneys to interpret for them. I speak Arabic. And it's a long story. We didn't even know if these two Tunisian prisoners knew we were coming. We didn't know if they would believe what we were here to help them. We didn't know if they would believe that we were anything other than the CIA trying to coax an interrogation out of them. And so I went with these two attorneys, and we met Mahmoud and Rafiq. And so I remember sitting down with Mahmoud, and I did the first thing I knew to do, which was introduce us by name in Arabic. And then I took out a piece of paper and just wrote down, I transliterated our English names into Arabic so he could read them fully. And I didn't realize what I had done at the time, because in Guantanamo Bay, all the military have name tags on. They cover them with duct tape, so no prisoner can ever read the name of his jailer. And all the prisoners are referred to by identification numbers. Muhammad was 892, Rafiq was 894. They had been completely isolated from identification. They'd had their identities taken from them, and they never knew the identities of their jailers. And what I understand in retrospect is when I walked into that prison cell and did the most natural, common thing, I never even thought twice about it, which was to identify myself by name and help this person understand exactly who I was, that was all they needed to believe that we were there to help them. So what's in a name? Our identity, our heritage, maybe our hopes, maybe our aspirations.
This is a big day because there is a new justice on the bench, Brett Kavanaugh, who was confirmed by the narrowest of margins after a very big fight.
And John Roberts, the Chief Justice, welcomed him with some very warm words, wishing him a long and happy career on the Supreme Court. In fact, Kavanaugh sits next to Justice Elena Kagan, who once hired him to teach at Harvard Law School. They had a really warm rapport. They were laughing in the beginning and talking and exchanging words that we couldn't hear. And then finally, after all the arguments were over, Kavanaugh shook Kagan's hand and left the bench.
So what do you think was going on there?
She is thinking about this guy who may be sitting next to her for the next 20 years and how to move him gently in one direction.
And that's so interesting because in the past, there were so many justices who moved away from the politics of the president that supported them.
Wow.
We're on the politics podcast. We're all focused on November 6th or who's winning the next week or the next news cycle. But when justices do politicking, that's how they do it. These justices play a game of 20 and 30 years.
So let me stop there and point out that these stories of transformation are examples of people who have spent a lifetime working on themselves to be the kinds of people in the moment that can make heroic decisions. Lois and Yuli didn't just wake up one day and decide to do the things they did. They probably understand themselves better than many of us do, and they understand what they're willing to give up for the things that they believe in, and they have strongly held convictions. That's what transformation looks like, and it starts from within. You can't go transform anybody else if you haven't worked on yourself. So now I'm going to share 3-minute segments from some of the best speakers I've collected in this podcast about ways to look at that transformation process.
I have a colleague, Daniel O'Connell, who used to put homework in the order of service on Sunday in his church. There were always 3 levels of homework, he said. Maybe it's like getting an A, B, or a C. I think of them as easier, more difficult, and truly heroic, as I remember it. The easiest was to voice your support in the voting booth or in polls or other opportunities when it could make a difference but won't cost you anything. Second level was to wear a rainbow pin on your breast every day to show your support wherever you are and to explain why you're wearing it when asked. Third was to advocate, protest, or even begin a movement in your neighborhood, in your workplace, in your school, or wherever. What homework might challenge you in the way that Dr. King would if he were still alive? Speaking up to oppose people who you know when you hear racist language, whether it's in your own house or in the White House, like we heard this week, but we can lose our soul if we don't speak out when we know something's right. We might live a long time, we might preserve a relationship, but we might be dying inside.
In 2013, a woman in Toronto, Canada, woke up, and as she was getting her coffee, she looked out the window and she saw there was a man sleeping on the bench in front of the bus stop that was across the way from her house. Well, she made a note of it because she was hoping he would be gone sometime during the day. But the next morning, she woke up and she looked out, and the man was still there. So she thought, I'll give it one more day, and then I'm going to call somebody. Because, you know, this is a nice place. This is my neighborhood. I don't want a homeless guy sleeping on the bench here. So the next morning she woke up, and as she was getting her coffee, she looked outside again, and the man was still there. So she picked up the phone and she called the police and she said, there is a homeless man who has been sleeping on this bench at the bus stop for 3 days now. I live in a nice neighborhood. I need you to come out and move him along. He needs to go find someplace else to sleep. A couple of hours later, the police knocked at her door and they said, ma'am, are you the one who called in about the homeless man? Yes, I am. Would you come with us, please? We'd like to show you something. Well, she's a little nervous, but okay. She follows them out the door. And as they're walking, she says, oh, man, what if he's dead? What if he died from a drug overdose and I hadn't called it in? As they drew a little bit closer, she noticed the man was covered in a blanket, everything from his head all the way down, except for his feet. His feet were sticking out of the blanket, and she thought, well, that's so odd because it's cold. Why would he leave his feet out? And as they drew nearer, she noticed something odd about his feet. There were marks in them, right in the center, little holes. And she gasped and she jumped back and she said, take him away. And they said, ma'am, it's just a statue. It's only a statue. Don't be afraid. And she said, I don't like it. Take it away. Homeless Jesus, as the statue was known as, is the work of a Canadian sculptor named Timothy Schmaltz. Timothy said he decided to create the sculpture to give a visual image of his understanding of the very real presence of Christ in the world, the image of God that is in each of us. So after he finished this statue, which is extraordinarily lifelike, he offered it to St. Michael's Cathedral in Toronto, Canada. And St. Michael's wrote him back and they said, thank you very much, but no thank you. We don't want it. He next offered it to St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York City, who said, it doesn't really fit with our image. We don't really want a statue of homeless Jesus. Well, the city of Toronto finally decided that they would take it, and that's how the statue ended up on this bench at a bus stop. Hundreds upon thousands of people pass the statue every day and never notice it. They never notice this man laying there, nor do they notice his feet sticking out and the nail holes in his feet. The ones that have noticed, well, some of them have formed a little group, and they're trying to get the statue removed. The organizer of the campaign says the statue creeps him out, and it's got to go. He says, you know, it's ridiculous, really. Jesus would never sleep on a bus bench. For goodness sake, he's God. I think it's tempting to look for Jesus, to want to experience Jesus just where we want him, where we can break him out every occasionally, our Jesus. And I believe that many of us try to do that because it's easier.
Courage isn't really about banishing our fears. Rather, courage is to possess something inside of us that is so strong, we will pursue it despite our fears. The night before we boarded our train, white supremacists and Klans people staged a big rally in Charlottesville. I was watching the other people on the platform watch us, wondering what they thought about this multiracial family with two dads, wondering who was going to share this train with us for the next 2 days. Because when I reflect further on why I booked this trip, I realized it wasn't just because you love trains. The truth is, given the climate of fear, division, and hate in our country right now, I needed to go looking again for the beauty and decency of our nation. There was at least one other father-son pair on the trip. The dad was a big white guy in his 50s with large calloused hands and a rough way of speaking. His 20-something son looked and sounded like he'd grow up to be a lot like his father. They sat down next to us in the observation car and my antenna immediately went up. Unfortunately, in our country right now, these men are precisely the people a gay dad traveling with his multiracial son is conditioned to be wary of. After a while, I could tell they were having a father-son talk about big life choices like spouses and careers. At one point, the dad put his hand on his son's shoulder and said with great tenderness, "Son, when you die, it doesn't matter how much money you've made. It matters how much love you've shared." One question I wrestle with, Nico, is what to do with the decency of people who disagree with us, who won't acknowledge our dignity as gay people or as people of color. Do we dismiss that decency as hypocrisy, or do we accept that decency at face value as a form of kindness? As a gay man, that's a question I've wrestled with for a long time, and you'll have to wrestle with it too. I think we need to accept it for what it is, to return kindness with kindness and try to build a bridge across the great chasms of mistrust. We get that we're strangers. We get that there's darkness and division. But we forget the part about being on the same train, headed into the same future together.
Discover the element of good in your enemy. That within the best of us there is some evil. And within the worst of us, there is some good. When we come to see this, we take a different attitude toward individuals. The person who hates you most has some good in him. Even the nation that hates you most has some good in it. Even the race that hates you most has some good in it. And when you come to the point that you look in the face of every man and see deep down within him what religion calls the image of God, you begin to love him in spite of, no matter what he does, you see God's image there. And that is an element of goodness that he can never slough off. That is the meaning of love. In the final analysis, love is not this sentimental something that we talk about. It is not merely an emotional something. Love is creative, understanding, goodwill for all men. It is a refusal to defeat any individual. When you rise to the level of love of its great beauty and power, you seek only to defeat evil systems. Individuals who happen to be caught up in that system you love, but you seek to defeat the system. The strong person is the person who can cut off the chain of hate, the chain of evil.
Living there, you will see what you truly wish to be. If you want to view paradise, simply look around. There is no what you'll find when you look into your imagination.
We come now to the close of a year that has proven that we as a nation have a heart problem. And somebody's got to be willing to go all the way until there is a transformation. We cannot stand down. Yes, with Dr. King, we must confess and testify there comes a time when silence is betrayal.
Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
If you want to view paradise, simply look around you. Anything you want to do it. Want to change the world. Life I know that compares with pure imagination. Living there, you'll be free if you truly wish to be.
That song, Pure Imagination, is one that I mixed with Martin Luther King and Reverend Barber back at the beginning of this podcast. And I think that it captures what I'm trying to share in each episode very succinctly. There's the first part of Martin Luther King talking about the dream, the middle part of Reverend Barber talking about the sacrifices that are required to be part of transformation. And the final part of Martin Luther King again, explaining that this is a process that's going to take a while. We're not going to see the end. We may be in the middle, we may be at the beginning. It's hard to say. In this next story I'd like to share, it's another illustration of the process of transformation.
I can't tell you how often I heard some version of this sentiment expressed in the past 12 years. The Israelis are the sole source of the problem. The Palestinians are nothing but a bunch of murderous thugs. America is the fount of all evil. The terrorists are pure and simple barbarians. What we share is far more important than what we don't, and all blood flows red, even the blood of my adversaries. Now that, that, my friends, is truly a radical, earth-shattering recognition that my enemies, too, can bleed. If I learned anything from my days at Amnesty, it's this, that no authentic person can live in this world unmoved by how immense is the tragedy that is creation. No pretty words from a pulpit can cover that up. No simple faith can fix it. No complex theology can explain it away. It just is. truly religious people know that, fear it, sometimes flee it, but more often do our best to face it. For we know that our job is not to deny evil or heartache or death, but to keep companion with them at the same time that we keep companion with blessings and possibility and grace. Losing our faith every single night and gaining it again with the coming of the day. That's what happened to me for 12 years at Amnesty International. I lost my faith almost every single night. And thank God I gained it again with the coming of the day. That's just the way it is with us human beings, flawed and fragile. I was often tempted to wish it otherwise, to never hear another story of torture, to never learn of another senseless killing, to never see tears again. But whenever I wished for a world like that, I reminded myself of just one thing. In the ancient world, a poetry contest was held each year, and the third place winner was presented a rose made out of silver. The second place winner, a rose made out of gold. But the first place winner received a real rose, a living rose, that while it was far from perfect and didn't live forever, spoke, while it did, of art and beauty and passion and power. And who among us, my friends, who among us, if we had to choose, would not choose the living rose?
There's a kind of a story that I sometimes share. A story about a man who dies, and he's at the gates of heaven. He's knocking at the gates of heaven. And God says, "Who is it?" And the man says, "It's me." And God says, "Go away." Thanks. This is ridiculous. "Here I am at the gates of heaven, I want to get in." He goes back. God says, "Who is it?" He says, "It's me, George." God says, "Go away, George." He thinks, "This is ridiculous. Here I am at the gates of heaven." And then he remembers. He remembers what he heard in this program. And he goes back to the gates and he knocks at the gate. God says, "Who is it?" And the man says, "It's you." And God says, "Come in." Some people live their whole lives and they isolate, separate. The guilt, the shame, the loneliness create a wall and they die. Can you find something of God in your life? Can you find something of that miracle, that preciousness, that specialness in your life? Because if you can, believe you me, you'll shine. And we have times when we have to face difficulties, and that's when this program really comes into place. And you know something? I've been at theological college, some of the best universities in England, and I've never heard this expression, "Find a God as you understand God." That was the key to my liberation. Not a God of the Pope, not a God of an archbishop, not a God of a priest, not a God of a body or of a group, but a God that makes sense to you. That's free. Ask, and you will be given the key to this world of mine. And who's the key? You are. You always were. Thank you.
Regardless of what happens in an election, our country is still going to be divided. People are still going to be hurting on the inside. There's still going to be a lack of unity and a greater need than ever for people to step up and seek to understand and find that part, that human dimension in our enemy and form bridges. I ask myself, how far would I go to help someone who may not appreciate what I sacrifice? And I bring these stories up about transformation because right now, everyone is waiting for this election vote to validate their politics, their worldview, their identity. And regardless of that outcome, an election doesn't unite a country. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't vote. We should all go vote. But voting is not the same as uniting. It's not the same as transforming. And the way that we put our faith in some election to somehow reverse the trend in society that's been happening for years to make us more divided than ever is what this is all about. If you truly believe in the American experiment and you want to see democracy flourish, then you need to join me in looking at who the real culprits are here. The two camps are not liberal and conservative, but those who seek to divide us and those that seek to unite us under some common belief. It doesn't mean that people adopt our beliefs. What has worked in the past is helping others to grow and adopt a new identity and help them want to shed the old identity.